Welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes each month of news, scandal and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The Taxcast is available to everyone on www.tackletaxhavens.com. It's also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, to the Tax Justice Network's YouTube channel, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, look for us on iTunes, or find us on a radio station near you. Coming up later on the show, tax and privatisation. But first, here's a quick Tax Justice news roundup. Swiss bank Credit Suisse admits in the United States, yes, we were running a criminal enterprise. But they say it was just a few rotten apples in their staff who were facilitating $10 billion worth of tax evasion. But there's no jail time and no question of them losing their licence to continue operating in the US. Here's economist Jim Henry interviewed on Democracy Now.
In this case, we have the second largest Swiss bank, a bank with 45,000 employees and 1.26 trillion Swiss franc of client assets under management, you know, getting away with essentially a fine that amounts to 3 months of their net earnings.
And it may be worse than that. Ordinary Swiss citizens may end up footing some of the $2.6 billion settlement because it's tax deductible. In the Swiss Parliament, there's now a battle raging between politicians who want to change the law on that and those who don't. The United States has signed up to the new single global standard endorsed by G20 nations earlier this year. But with states like Delaware making such a great living out of secrecy, will Congress try to block it? We'll have more on that later. There's not a drop of oil coming out of the Swiss mountains, but still Royal Dutch Shell has 8 subsidiaries there. That's according to SOMO, the Centre for Research on Multinational Corporations and Friends of the Earth Europe. Their report, The Swiss Connection, accuses the oil company Shell of using Swiss secrecy to potentially avoid taxes where its genuine economic activities are, including in developing countries. How do investors, customers and government regulators deal with the almost 30,000 subsidiaries of FTSE 100 companies? That's what Christian Aid's asking in their latest report, Footsecrecy. I like the title. Apparently almost all of these subsidiaries are based in secrecy jurisdictions and only 26% of them provide details for free of the subsidiaries' turnover, assets, shareholder funds and number of employees. Google's been challenged on its tax affairs, not by the usual suspects like us, but this time at their own annual meeting by their own shareholders. The Domini Social Equity Fund and its partners asked the board of directors to, quote, adopt a set of principles to address the impact of Google's tax strategies on society, with particular focus on Google's employees, customers and suppliers, close quote. And we'll talk about that in a moment. Stand by for more professional facilitation of looting and tax abuse, because this month the China Offshore Summit takes place in Beijing. And I'm quoting directly here from their website. China's high net worth individuals, investment groups and corporations have developed an ever-increasing need for sophisticated international wealth tax and asset planning services. Indeed. And here's another quote. The China Offshore Summit has been designed exclusively by China Offshore and local practitioners to educate Chinese financial intermediaries on the effective use of tax planning and asset management tools available in low-tax jurisdictions. And finally, you may remember a few months ago the Taxcast covered the Bahamas in edition 26. The government there was planning to try to patch up the ailing economy with a regressive value-added tax. This tax would mean ordinary, struggling Bahamians would pay disproportionately more than wealthier citizens. The government there's delayed implementing the tax for now, and the Bahamian cause may have just received a helping hand from the governor of the central bank in Barbados. Now, Barbados implemented VAT back in 2010, and he's just recommended they abandon it. It's really a shame, isn't it, that these governments refuse to consider the benefits of a progressive tax system instead. Those are the TaxCast headlines for this month. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, this month the United States has agreed to the idea of automatic electronic and multilateral information exchange of their residents' tax and financial information. And they're the biggest single exporter of financial services, so that's obviously really important. But there's lots of big interests, obviously, totally against any such agreement, not least secrecy jurisdictions like Delaware, which is one of the world's biggest. So how likely do you think Congress is to agree to this single global standard the G20 is supposed to be working towards?
Well, what's been happening in the last few months is quite extraordinary. If we look back 2 or 3 years ago, we now have close to 95% of the world's providers of offshore financial services notionally committing themselves to automatic information exchange, which will be multilateral and reciprocal. That's fantastic. On paper, it sounds great. The United States have now said that they will commit to reciprocal information exchange. In other words, they will exchange information with other countries and not just impose an information sharing requirement on other countries. They will reciprocate. And this is great news. Will it happen? I'm afraid it's time for a bit of a reality check. We know that the financial services lobbies in the United States are extremely powerful. We're up against some of the most powerful states in this area as well. I mean, Delaware, Nevada and other states, including Texas and Florida, will resist. There'll be an extraordinarily powerful lobbying effort put in by the major US banks. I think this one is very unlikely to go through Congress in the near future, unless President Obama is prepared to put enormous personal effort into making this happen. Words, as we know, are very, very cheap indeed. Many countries are under public pressure to commit to multilateral reciprocal automatic information exchange. But what we're seeing now is the backlash to that pressure. And the backlash doesn't just come from the powerful lobbies within the United States or within Europe. We're also seeing, sadly, a backlash from the developing countries. Now, the real problem here, because developing countries need to have this information, they probably suffer more from tax evasion and tax avoidance than the world's developed countries. But their governments are not really showing a huge amount of commitment to pushing forward in this area. Partly because they're saying, well, we can't immediately reciprocate, we have to invest in the right computer technologies and getting our systems up to speed. And there might well be a very strong case for saying, yes, we'll give you a 5-year period to phase in this and not require reciprocity immediately from the poorer countries. But at the same time, we could provide aid to help them make that transition to being able to provide reciprocal information exchange. But what I fear is happening now is that the political elites and the business elites around the world are beginning to kick back against pressure for automatic information exchange. And I think that pressure is going to be building up, not just amongst the obvious culprits like Switzerland and Luxembourg, but also within the United States and sadly amongst many developing countries as well.
Not too promising. And, you know, we're seeing a new prime minister in India as well. And I'm wondering how that's going to affect the issue. And also, you have to wonder when countries like Switzerland and Singapore are signing up to this G20 global standard, you've got to wonder what they've got up their sleeve. And reciprocity is probably the key word they are banking on. I mean, literally, because as Switzerland knows perfectly well, corrupt money tends to flow out of developing countries to jurisdictions like theirs, not the other way around, right?
Well, that is absolutely right. Countries like Switzerland are extremely slippery.
And you do have to ask what sort of credibility the UK government has as well when they're failing to clean up their own backyards. Because we look at, we were talking about Delaware, the UK government, as we've seen, is kind of a self-appointed leader in promoting public registries of beneficial owners, although we've got the cabinet of millionaires still trying to exempt trusts from that register. And now it looks like UK overseas territories and crown dependencies are going to be encouraged but not forced on the issue of signing up to the Registry of Beneficial Ownership by the UK government.
In October 2013, Prime Minister Cameron, who at that time headed G8, made a very, very strong commitment that the G8 would lead, and Britain in particular, would lead with moving towards a global transparency initiative requiring offshore companies to disclose more information, and in particular information about who owns this. And that sounded great. Ahead of that G8 summit, Prime Minister Cameron called in the British overseas territories and the British Crown dependencies, Jersey, Guernsey, Isle of Man, and all of these territories, and said, "We now are moving to a new era of transparency. You will have to create public registries and put information about corporate ownership on these registries." Immediately, this raises the question about, well, what about the gaps here? And in particular, what about the issue of trusts? Because many British territories specialise in trusts which aren't registered and disclose no information about themselves. But now the British government will not be imposing or requiring British territories to create registries. They'll simply be encouraging them. And the feedback from the territories themselves tells us that they are going to do their utmost to avoid having any real change here. They're going through a process of public consultation, but who are they consulting? They're consulting the local banks and the local accounting firms and the local lawyers. And we all know that all of these companies make their money out of selling secrecy. So this consultation is a completely bogus process, and the British overseas territories and crown dependencies will not move towards having public registries. So the British Prime Minister is going to be very deeply embarrassed by this. This, I fear, is going to be a G8 failure.
Another one to add to the list. Let's talk about Google now, because they had a challenge from shareholders at their annual meeting this month. The board of directors, of course, recommended a no vote. This was a proposal that Google adopt a set of principles to address the impact of Google's tax strategies on society. Evidently, Google directors don't actually know what the word principle even means. But now the firm who made this proposal is called the Domini Social Equity Fund. Interesting organisation. Their managing director says, "Contrary to popular belief, minimising corporate tax payments is not good for shareholders." And he says it threatens innovation and economic growth. Tell us what happened to the vote.
The proposition, which was that Google should adopt an ethical policy on tax, was rejected, but the board has agreed to open discussions with the corporate shareholders who put the proposition forward, particularly with this company, Domini Social Investments. Also, there was sufficient support to be able to carry forward the proposition to 2015. So this is something that's going to build up. And what's fascinating is that here you have a group of shareholders who are saying, look, it's in our longer-term interests to recognise that not only is the company there to maximise its profits, but it's also to look at the long-term profit flows. And that means contributing, investing in all of the services that the companies require. And that includes not just public education and infrastructure maintenance, but also the judicial systems, the market regulation, the law enforcement that a company like Google, which is a monopoly, needs in order to operate effectively around the world. So this was quite an astonishing move, an excellent proposition. And it was particularly good that American shareholders are saying, it is in our interests to have an ethical policy and a clear policy on tax avoidance, because we don't think that tax avoidance is in shareholders' long-term interest.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Too many corporations have a mindset that says it's okay to take from society, benefit from all it has to offer, yet offshore profits, pay no taxes, and close down public scrutiny through lack of transparency. And some of these companies are busy buying up public assets and profiting from running public services. This month, the TaxCast looks at the disadvantage to privatisation that's less talked about. Tax.
Hay algo que nos impulsa a crecer, a esforzarnos para ser mejores.
This is one of many slick videos telling us what a great company Isagen is. It's Colombia's third largest electricity generator and it brings in $200 million a year back to the taxpayer. So why does the government want to sell off Colombia's majority stake in the company? They say they want to use the money raised to improve Colombian roads. But campaigners there think it just doesn't add up. Union leader Gerardo Sandibanez.
That heritage that the generation of electricity brings in, which is the property of the Colombian state and all Colombians, generated 220 million pesos. Colombia is going against its own development. Government politicians are going against the progress of their citizens.
Gubernamentales van en contravía del progreso de sus ciudadanos.
Now campaigners have won a temporary reprieve. A judicial authority has suspended the sale and the Colombian government must justify why it thinks the sale of this profitable company is in the public interest. Colombians are right to be worried. And not only about the loss of income the company generates, the likelihood of price rises for consumers, and the certainty that governments will need to heavily subsidise infrastructure improvements in the future. When companies like this get into private hands, nations can lose huge amounts of tax revenue through needlessly high levels of debt and the offshoring of profits. More about that in a moment. But it often seems the arguments about privatisation have been fought and lost, and the conversation's over. Here's philosopher Michael J. Sandel.
I think two things have been happening in recent decades. One of them is the impoverishment of civic discourse. Another thing that's been happening, it's gotten perhaps less attention, is the reach of markets and market thinking into spheres of life traditionally governed by non-market values. And this has been happening over roughly the last three decades. You might almost call a period of market triumphalism. A time when there's been a growing faith in the idea that markets are the primary instrument for achieving the public good.
That may be the narrative, but for many companies, these are just straightforward business decisions, because buying up public assets is pretty much a no-brainer for investors. Journalist George Turner wrote a report on the privatisation of water in the UK called Money Down the Drain.
A water company would never fail because people always need water, and it's the same with gas and oil and electricity. The people always demand. These companies have very, very stable revenue streams. You can predict how much money the company will be receiving very accurately in 5 years' time, which is rare in companies. So they are seen as very safe investments.
Back in the 1990s, the privatisation of the water industry was presented to the British public as their opportunity to own shares at low risk. They were beckoned into a world of shareholding they'd never thought was for them. George Turner again.
What's changed quite dramatically since that time is that now in the water industry, most of the enterprises are no longer stock market listed. Therefore, you or I or no one else could go to the stock market and buy shares in these companies. They're all privately owned, either by banks or private equity firms, or sometimes even just by families. And sovereign wealth funds also make up a large proportion of the ownership of these public enterprises, such as China and the Emirates. And what we've seen, which is kind of interesting, is a kind of reverse nationalisation of some of the industries, but they've been nationalised by foreign governments. So, for example, you take Thames Water, which is the largest company in the UK, 10% of that is owned by the Chinese government, and none is owned by the UK government.
Of course, it's tempting for governments to raise big sums of money quickly by selling off public assets. Back in the 1970s and 80s, water management in Britain was in a poor state. But the incentives for governments to invest long-term are low, given they always have their eye on five-year general election cycles, especially if privatisation's their end game anyway.
It seems like it's a win-win for everybody. But in the long term, those returns don't go back to the general public, they go back into private hands.
Apparently one-third of the money spent by people on water bills in England and Wales went to paying the interest on the 19 water companies in England and Wales debts or paying out as dividends. A third of your water bill?
Companies will always need to borrow money. The question is, can it be done cheaper if you borrow the money as a government-owned enterprise or as a privately owned enterprise?
Right, because a private company borrows at higher rates than it would if it was borrowing as a public company.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, it's even worse than that, because I think what we have seen is borrowing in some public service companies, which can be called public service companies, at much higher rates than you would expect an equivalent company to be borrowing at. Often these debts are routed through tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions. They're euro bonds, so they are done as paper certificates rather than as registered bonds, so we cannot see the beneficial owners. And there is a large suspicion in these cases whether there is actually, it's an inside job, whether the interest rates are being manipulated in order to give a greater return to the owners. Now, that's something that the water companies, a lot of them, would vehemently deny. But when they structure their debt portfolio in a way where no one can understand or see who is the owners of those debt portfolios, that suspicion will always be there.
Right, because it's a really common tax avoidance technique to minimise the tax that you would pay by appearing to be borrowing lots of money. And as we say, it's impossible for us to say exactly what's going on because of these very complex structures, but it is a tax avoidance technique, so that's costing us tax revenue, right?
Absolutely. I mean, most of the water companies in the UK haven't paid taxes in several years because their interest payments come off profits. They're counted as a cost of doing business, so therefore corporation tax gets paid after interest deductions. Now, because these interest payments have been so high, it means the water companies have not paid taxes. So interestingly as well, the government regulator, which regulates prices in the water sector, think that a well-financed water company should have between 55 and 65% debt and the rest financed as equity, or what we would know as stocks or shares. Today we are approaching an average of around 70 in the industry, I think, with 70% debt, with some companies well into the 80s. So they're borrowing far more than the regulator thinks they should be able to, and then that debt gets taken off tax. In the water industry, definitely, there's very strange corporate structures which involve a whole kind of wedding cake of companies doing nothing but lending billions of pounds to each other.
And to themselves.
And to themselves.
Within their own structures.
Indeed. And the private equity-owned businesses all have many, many more debts than public sector companies or even stock market-listed companies. The scope for increasing returns to investors through increasing efficiency is relatively small. So when you see these people getting spectacular returns on their investment in the private sector, you have to really question where that's coming from.
Where is it coming from?
Well, it's coming from lowering the tax bill. It's coming from increasing the amount of finance costs. It's coming through not investing in the infrastructure. It's coming from increasing bills.
I don't blame businesses. They use every possible avenue to lower their costs and increase their profits. That's what they do.
Donald Cohen of In the Public Interest, a US resource centre on privatisation and responsible outsourcing of public services.
The question comes down to is what's the process? What's the evaluation analysis process? And almost never do they do a full analysis that allows people to compare all the impacts and all the costs. And that's really probably the biggest problem of outsourcing. The process of contracting is so thin and poorly done in so many places that things just tend to move out the door once a decision has been made to try to do it. Even if public sector can do it cheaper and better. Just in the United States, there's $6 trillion spent every year by local, state, and federal government. It's a huge pot of gold, and corporations are looking at getting into that stream, and that's absolutely true globally as well.
U.S. educationalist Daniel Wheel.
We've been told that government doesn't work. We have been told that education doesn't work. We have been told that the teachers are the problem. We have been told that there is no money for schools, and schools have been starved, strangled for over 33 years in the amount of money that they receive from the state and the amount of money they receive from the federal government. This is purposeful. It's not a conspiracy. It's a business plan. When you're in a group of people in a corporate boardroom and you're trying to figure out how you can take over a $650 billion industry, which is what kindergarten through college represents, it's a $650 billion industry. And Wall Street wants it, and they want it badly.
So, run the public service or asset into the ground and feed stories to the media on how it's failing to then justify why it must be sold off or contracted out. Does that sound familiar? But let's finish off by looking at what happened when some very civic-minded managers bought privatised Welsh Water back from the struggling company that owned it.
Basically, they did a kind of nationalisation of the water industry, but without any involvement of the government, and it's not run by the government. And so now Welsh Water is a not-for-profit company. So what happened was a private equity-style management buyout, as we see in other industries. However, instead of them keeping the shares for themselves and becoming billionaires over the next 5 years, they decided to put those shares into a trust, which would be held for the benefit of the people of Wales. And now every year, instead of those shares producing a dividend to investors, people in Wales get a rebate on their water bills. Over the last few years, the company has received more thank you letters than it has complaints, which is absolutely extraordinary for a utility company. Its level of service and quality of service is excellent. It also has the lowest levels of debt in the industry, so therefore finances itself at very low interest rates and is financially very efficient. So it is, by all accounts, a successful company. Does probably better in terms of the quality of service than most private sector companies, and lives up to its obligations for investing in a network and increasing the quality of service.
Interesting, isn't it? You've been listening to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.